We believe life can be a journey toward wholeness, toward reconnecting with who we are authentically meant to be. We walk this path of growth and discovery with our children, with our partners, within ourselves. These are the stories of what's possible. These are the conversations that light the way. Welcome to Soul Path Parenting.
Hi, Amy.
Hi, Lauren.
I'm so excited to be here to talk about the conversation that we're going to be sharing today, in which we invited Patricia Pierce, wisdom teacher and author of Beyond Jesus, back on the podcast. One, because we love her. Two, because Easter is coming up, and you and I had had a conversation about our childhood experiences with Christianity, Easter, sin, judgment, redemption, these themes that, you know, can come up with the idea of the cross, the crucifixion, the resurrection. And in Patricia's amazing, grounded, and infinite way, she's able to take difficult questions that we bring to her and expand our understanding of these ideas in a way that connects us to unitive consciousness without leaving anything behind, which I love because I'm all about transcend and include. Nothing gets left behind. So I thought maybe we could start by setting this up a little and sharing what we grew up with, what the limited ideas we grew up with in relation to Jesus, Christianity, Easter, crucifixion, redemption, these heavy topics. Yeah. Do you want to share a little bit?
I will. And as I've said before, and I even say in the conversation with Patricia, I grew up outside of Christianity, but like only a little bit outside of Christianity in the sense that I was never baptized. I was not taken to church on any regular basis. We didn't identify in any particular faith, but yet my mother was raised Catholic. My father was raised a variety of different forms of Protestantism, depending on what was available on the different Air Force bases he grew up on. And I also grew up in Gainesville, Florida, which is influenced by the Southern culture around Christianity. And I grew up very clearly understanding that I was supposed to believe that Jesus died on the cross for my sins and that I would be judged, and that anyone who didn't believe what was being said or preached was going to hell. Like, that was what I understood as a kid. And it was all so confusing and alienating, because also, think about it, I'm both trying to understand and be almost persuaded by this story that begins with how flawed I am. And also, I am in an out-group. I'm in the out-group they're referring to. It was all just entirely confusing. And the wonderful thing for me about this conversation with Patricia is how she bridges this really confusing and fraught understanding, the only lens on spirituality that I had as a kid, with this possible, just expansive, as you said, experience of what we can connect with as a spiritual path. And for me, what's so powerful in the conversation that we're teeing up is how, first of all, what she says, it's almost like my questions start out almost inadequate to where she's going to expand and take them, but we all have to begin somewhere. I'm not apologizing for the questions, but where she takes them is so powerful. The subject matter itself is so powerful. And also, and I say this every time we tee her up, this is the third time that she's appearing on the show, she so embodies love and oneness that even just being in the presence of this conversation to me is a transformational experience. And I hope that it is for our listeners as well. How about you?
Yes, yes to all of that. And it's been fascinating, I think, for you and I to share our different experiences growing up and then also find the kind of Venn diagram overlaps that we identify between us, because I grew up inside of Catholicism under the larger umbrella of Christianity. And I remember, you know, being brought from a very young age to the Stations of the Cross each year as part of the ritual leading up to Easter. We would walk through the Stations of the Cross and hear about how Jesus was crucified, like you say, for our sins. You know, I grew up with that idea too, that because of sinful, bad humanity, poor Jesus had to be dragged through these stations. Well, he went willingly, which was another layer of amazingness about him. But he willingly participates in this experience of being, you know, walked towards his own physical death and abused and, you know, all of these things. And growing up as a young child, being taught year after year, he did this for you. He had to do this for you. This happened because of you. And even being inside and being taught, and as long as you believe in him and try to, you know, be good, now that he's redeemed the world, you'll go to heaven. The reality of being a complicated human child is such that, you know, even being inside didn't equate to me feeling like, oh, I've got this. This is good. This is great. I'm fine. You know, it was more like, holy crap, this is what he had to do for me. And I've got to keep visiting this every year. And it's confusing. And the messages get, I feel like parts of the message get lost and parts get overemphasized. And that's what I love about talking with Patricia, because we can bring her those, like you said, those kind of one-sided questions that we were left with because we had these experiences that didn't feel whole or complete. And she can kind of zoom out and fill in the bigger picture in a way that feels more whole and complete and loving. And I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. So I'm just so excited. It's transformational for me being in her presence. And I am so grateful to get to be a part of this and to share it with people.
Amen, sister.
Yes. All right, let's go to the interview.
Hello, Patricia, and welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be back with both of you. I've been looking forward to it.
I'm so excited for today.
I am too. So have we. We've really been looking forward to this. And I want to get us started grounding ourselves in a couple of themes that we specifically wanted to start out this conversation around: sin and judgment. And we had specifically scheduled this show to happen now, leading into Easter, leading into this season. And it connects in my mind to this idea of sin, because I've explained before that I grew up as sort of an outsider to Christianity, but an onlooker. And of course, I grew up in a very Christian community of people. And it is so emblazoned into my memory, being told so many times that Jesus died on the cross for my sins. And I'm wondering, what do you make of the idea of sin, and how does Jesus connect with it?
Yeah, well, that's an easy question to get going with. Well, we've talked before, as when I've been on your podcast before, about this historic shift that we're making into unitive consciousness, out of the consciousness of the ego mind or the idea of separateness. And from my vantage point, that idea of separateness is at the heart of essentially all of our like dilemmas that we've created for ourselves as humans. And it's just an idea. I mean, it's an idea that's falling apart. I mean, you can ask, you know, you can ask a physicist, you can ask a biologist, you can ask a geneticist, and they'll tell you, and a mystic, and they'll all tell you that separateness isn't real. But we've lived inside of that story for millennia. The idea of sin and judgment is part of that story, that it's part of that egoic mind story. Reality is interconnectedness. It is relationship. It is love. And love doesn't judge. Love doesn't exclude. Love doesn't cast anything out of itself. For one thing, it can't. So sin and judgment is just this idea that arises out of this notion of being separate. And in this case, it's, you know, in the case of like Christian belief, it's the idea of being separate from God. It's the idea of being separate from our source. It's the idea of being cast out of, you know, quote, the Garden of Eden because we did something bad. So that idea of judgment goes very deep, and it is foundational actually to the egoic mind. And when we begin to let go of judgment, we begin to move out of the ego. We begin to dismantle that whole belief system. So the way I see it, Jesus is someone who experienced an enlightened consciousness and knew himself to be one with the all, knew himself to be completely beloved, knew that we were operating in this world in this sort of trance state of our badness, of our separateness. And the way I see it, how far to zoom out here? So if we think about the cross symbolically, it's a symbol of that whole egoic story that is, you know, the idea of the other, the idea of enemies, the idea of dominating, controlling, attacking, violence. The cross was a tool of the empire, which is all about domination and control. So if we look at the cross symbolically, it is a symbol of that story of separateness. It's a symbol of the ego mind. And the way I see it is, I think I might have, I don't remember if I talked about this when I've been on the show before, but in an awakening experience that I had, it culminated with this realization that we are in a dream, that this world, we are enacting a dream, we're enacting our unconscious beliefs. And so things that are happening in the world have a symbolic content, a symbolic meaning. So in the case of Jesus, someone who saw through the dream, like he was like a lucid dreamer on the planet, I guess you could say, like he'd awakened from that dream state. So how do you snap people out of the idea of separateness? How do you show them that it's just a story? Well, one way is you experience the cross, you go to the heart of the symbol of that story, you enact that story, and something happens on the other side of it that totally negates the whole story, which is the resurrection.
Wow.
So the resurrection is the evidence that the cross is our own fiction, and that separateness and judgment and sin is our own fiction. It's a story in the human mind. That's all it is. And he, of course, was attempting to, you know, help us awaken to our own divine nature. So what happened, though, is that when you're working with dreams, you can interpret them in many different ways. And symbols can be interpreted in many different ways. Mm-hmm. So this event of the crucifixion and the resurrection became interpreted by the egoic mind as evidence that we are sinful, that look at this, God's son had to die because we're so sinful. So it got twisted and interpreted according to the consciousness state that Jesus wanted to dissolve.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I have to say, it gave me goosebumps when you were explaining what the resurrection really was meant to show, because I haven't ever been aware of that before. I haven't seen that before. Lauren, were you? How do you take that?
The way I'm hearing that is the resurrection was symbolizing the truth that we are love, we are interconnectedness, we are that even nailing Jesus to the cross and killing him didn't negate the truth. And his resurrection was evidence of the truth. So Jesus embodying and speaking out about love consciousness, unitive consciousness, Christ consciousness. I mentioned this in our last conversation. Sometimes that's received by people who are functioning at the level of the egoic mind as an attack. Like, they'll sometimes receive Jesus's message or someone else, another human embodying and sharing that same message. We're all one. We're not enemies. Yes, we are. No, we're not. We're not enemies. Well, now you're my enemy and I will kill you. I will smite you. I will prove it.
Yeah.
And then Jesus rose from the dead to say, you can't kill the truth.
Yeah. Yes. Mm. And in a sense, you could say that the resurrection is a proclamation of the impotence of the ego story. Like, it is impotent. It has no ultimate power. But if we consider, and this, I know this is a stretch, this makes no sense to most people, but if we look at this world as a form of dream, let's just play with it as a thought experiment, right? If we look at it as a form of dream, we all know what it's like to fall asleep at night and have a dream, right? We all know that. We know that experience. And we know that when we are in the dream, it is absolutely real to us. It is absolutely real to us. We are experiencing the things that are happening in the dream. And we are experiencing, you know, the mental anguish, if it's that kind of a dream, if it's a nightmare. We are experiencing the fear. So all of that experience we are having, even though it's a dream. So I know, like, it's really hard to accept that this world might be a form of a dream. But if we can play with it from that perspective, then I think we get a deeper dimension into what is transpiring and how it is that, when we dream, we are playing out the deeper beliefs in our minds. We are playing out those subconscious beliefs. They are becoming enacted symbolically in our dream. And our dreams can show us what parts of ourselves need to be healed or integrated or recognized and acknowledged. So all of these things then that are happening in this dream world, we can look at them more deeply and ask the question, like, what is happening here that is trying to wake me up from my story of separateness? And it's a totally different way of looking at things. If we come at it from the vantage point of all is love, and if we want to use, you know, God language, we say God is love. There is nothing but love, ultimately. Except when we drop into the illusion, when we drop into the dream, then we create an unloving experience for ourselves, and we create an unloving world. So the whole idea of enemy, yeah, it's just part of the dream. And just, you know, we all believe it at some point or another, you know. We all buy into that. But that doesn't mean that it's true. Just because we believe it doesn't mean that it's true.
Yeah. I love the language of describing this human experience as a dream, because I've been deepening my study of the metaphysics and the dimensions and how we live in this 3D world that has time and space, but it's all a projection of the one consciousness. And that's really hard conceptually to wrap your head around in human form with just this quote unquote reality. And so I feel that the metaphor of dream is so helpful because that's sort of the closest proxy that many of us have had, unless perhaps some people are now experiencing that oneness through psychedelics. But for those who haven't, the dream feels like the closest metaphor to what that experience is being described in what I've been studying.
Yeah. Well, and I love the framework of awakening, and I love thinking about being able to be in a dream while awake, like the sleepwalking idea, or, you know, because for me, if we talk about this in terms of how conscious or unconscious am I in a particular moment, like is my unconscious driving? Because in Amy and my coaching program, we talked a lot about our unconscious and our conscious mind, what we're consciously aware of, what's unconsciously driving, that in any given moment, a human may, if they're lucky, be conscious of more than 5% of what's going on. You know, yeah. Like the statistics suggest that we're conscious of roughly 5, maybe 10%, and the rest is all happening unconsciously. And that unconscious layer for me is like the dream world, the dream layer. And when I'm functioning in the world and I'm unconsciously being driven by my unconscious thoughts, I'm acting out a dream in a way, and I'm acting out things that aren't true. And I love the Buddhist concept of clear seeing. When you can clearly see, oh, that's my unconscious again. Oh, that's that story that I've absorbed that lives inside me, but it's not true.
Yes. And to see it, to recognize it, and not to judge it. See, that's where we get tripped up. You know, we see it. You know, we might have moments of seeing it, and then we judge ourselves for having been duped, if you will. And that's that we sort of fall back asleep at that moment, because judgment isn't real.
Right.
But judgment goes so core in our minds. And when you really start noticing it, it's phenomenal how deep it goes. Mm-hmm. How ready we are to judge not only other people, but ourselves.
Right.
And then when we start to notice that how much we judge, then we start to judge ourselves for judging.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's like this, it just feeds on itself. It's like this loop. And to break that and really, you know, to see through the eyes of love, it's like, oh, wow, I was judging there. How about that? And now I'm learning the ways of love. Isn't that beautiful? And I'm learning that judgment isn't real. Isn't that beautiful? So to even have compassion on ourselves for our judging begins to lift us out of that story or that trance state.
Yes. I was teaching something very similar recently, Patricia, and there's an exercise that both Lauren and I have done called a judgment detox, where you essentially, I'll give it to the listeners so that you can try it yourselves. It's super powerful. Step one in any of this is cultivating awareness, becoming aware. And so you spend, you could say 3 days, three times a day, writing down all your judgments that you can think of that you've had. And just by cultivating awareness, we start to see, oh my gosh, this is like my first language. It's as if this is the only language I know how to speak is judgment, 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 judgment. Look at my thoughts. They're just all judgment. And like you said, the irony of now I'm judging that I'm a judger. Oh my gosh. And so
is it any wonder that people decided that the cross had to be about judgment?
Right. Because this is the language we're so fluent in as humans. Mm-hmm. And, well, in any case, it's very instructive first to become aware of those judgments. And then I think as you grow the awareness, you can start to have facility to choose, as you were saying. I love how you put that, that, oh, and now I'm learning to come from love, right? That's what's available. And I'm curious, because we have, you have such a deep expertise in Jesus and sort of both sides of the coin, the stories that are told within Christianity, as well as the Christ consciousness that you've shared about on the podcast. If we could learn from you what Jesus actually either said or meant to say, what he might have taught related to the concept of judgment.
Well, probably his most famous saying is, judge not or you'll be judged. And the way I hear that is, again, it's in the mind. Judge not or you will be judging, like yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when we judge, it comes back on us. So if you want to be judged, then judge. So it's you know, that's probably, you know, the most cryptic teaching of his. That and, you know, we tend to externalize that. Like, if I judge that person's going to judge me. Mm-hmm. But I see it much more as an internal state.
Yeah.
That, you know, the shift in consciousness is an internal state. And if we choose to continue to indulge judgment in our own minds, we will retain that pattern in ourselves, and we will direct it at ourselves. So we will continue judging ourselves just as we judge others. So it, again, it's like that feedback loop, right, that we get caught in. And Jesus, you know, we don't know exactly, because the Gospels come to us through accounts of people who may not have seen with a clear lens themselves. But one of the things that seemed to irritate people the most about him was that he didn't judge. Hmm. And that drove people crazy. Mm-hmm. Like, he wasn't participating in the judgment stories and the judgment criteria of his day. And because that was so infuriating and offensive to people, we can see how core that is to the ego mind. Why would the mind get so upset about not judging unless judgment is core to the ego's belief system?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he mostly, you know, he got frustrated with people who were like religious leaders and such, who were continuing to perpetuate the judgment and the exclusion. So, you know, I guess one could say that he was judging people for judging, but I don't think that's the case. I think he was just frustrated. Like, aren't you all getting this? Aren't you all getting this? Like, it is about love, and he was all about love. And he, you know, his capacity for love was something that people experienced as deeply healing, deeply healing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, his ability to be present, and I imagine him similar to how you describe him in Beyond Jesus, actually, Patricia, where, you know, he's at one point compared to a shaman, a great healer. And I experience a lot of the stories about Jesus that way. I also think he was so aware and awake and conscious that he was holding up a really clear mirror to the leaders that were behaving in hypocritical ways, and they didn't like seeing that. Yeah. So they chose instead to not see that and vilify Jesus for showing that to them. And I think similar to what you were just saying, that, you know, could we say, was he judging people for judging? But that's not quite right. For me, it feels more like, was he holding up a mirror and they didn't like the mirror? And so, because they had a choice then. When someone holds up that clear of a mirror for you, you can go, oh, wow, here's my opportunity to see myself more clearly. Thank you. Like, ouch, but also thank you for that
mirror.
And
if I really don't like what I'm seeing, and I really don't want to acknowledge it, I will throw that back. I'll project it. Like I will, you know, I'll throw it back to the person who's showing me. Mm-hmm. That's a great image, Lauren. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's fascinating to me to think about where this started and Amy's question, because I keep thinking, so how did we get so stuck on Jesus died for your sins? I know what you're talking about, Amy, that message and the confusion. And maybe I'm doing some projecting here too. I don't know exactly what it was like for you, but I feel like part of what was inherent in your question was, how do we disentangle some of the ways Jesus and the cross and these things are talked about from who Jesus actually was and what Jesus's message was, from what's true and what's actually obscuring the truth or misconstruing it, things like that. Because that whole Jesus died for your sins because you're bad, there's so many different ways to frame that. If I identify with the ego-minded humans who murdered him, which if I'm being completely honest, I am like them sometimes because I contain everything, right? Mm-hmm. Then there's a level of truth to that accusation. Jesus died because of you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can get there. But, you know, to a child, so Amy and I talked before this conversation about our different experiences, and I grew up in the Catholic Church, and being a young kid, walked through the Stations of the Cross every year and asked to focus on these things. And I grew up in the Catholic Church where our giant cross up at the front of the church has a body of Jesus with wounds and blood and you know, things like that. Unlike some of the other denominations that choose to have the empty cross. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in the, we want you to see this kind of a place, not to judge it too much, but I'm human, so I'm going to do some judging. So, and just growing up with that and trying to make sense of it, and that the being presented with my badness in a way that wasn't, it didn't feel helpful or balanced to me. So I feel like, you know, I grew up with incomplete messages being given to me in certain ways. I eventually rejected those things and walked away. I kind of feel like I have my own hero's journey with Catholicism. You know, I was indoctrinated in it, and then I rejected it and I walked away. And during that period of time, I judged it all as bad. Like, oh, it's all bad. So now I'm leaving it behind. I'm leaving all that badness behind. And part of my personal evolution and growth and awakening has included a returning and some redemption for some of what was in there that, had it been explained in a more complete, clear, seeing way, could have actually been really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, as you're speaking, Lauren, I'm remembering this dream that I had a few years ago where I'm visiting this. It's a convent that has, it's closing up. It's like all the sisters are, you know, they're passing on, like the convent is dying. And I think it's going to be, I don't know, turned into a restaurant, I think. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of like scouting out the space, you know, like, I'm thinking it's actually off the beaten track. And I'm not sure they're going to get a lot of clientele for this restaurant. I'm not sure if they're going to really make it. Uh-huh. And then I walk into this room that's part of the convent. And this room has grass. It doesn't have floor. It has grass. And it is filled, covered, like the grass is covered, and the room is filled with butterflies of every conceivable color. And I know that the nuns have kept this alive all this time. Like at the heart of this tradition is this profound transformation. And it was hidden away. It was nurtured. It was kept safe. And now I feel like, you know, the time is coming when the butterflies are, you know, they're coming out of that room. Anyway, mm-hmm. So when I see that, I'm like, wow, they're going to have no trouble getting customers for this restaurant. This is amazing. but it is that, it, like, at the core of it all, there is something deeply transformative. And what can be more symbolic of complete transformation than a butterfly? The total metamorphosis of a creature.
Mm-hmm.
That deep, absolute transformation is at the core of this message. And it has not been understood. It has been misconstrued, again, you know, because it was seen through the lens of the ego mind. But it's there. And I feel like, you know, more and more people are sort of pulling back the curtain, pulling back the misunderstandings and the misinterpretations, and discovering what is really there, which is the absolute transformation. It is the emergence of really a new human. Like, that is what Christ consciousness is about. It's about the emergence of a new humanity. And we're in the time when this is happening. This consciousness is arising.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about your experience, Lauren, of walking away, you know, from the tradition and then coming back to it in some form and reclaiming it for yourself, the parts that spoke to you, I'm reminded of a dream that I also tell in my story Beyond Jesus that you referenced earlier. And this dream came to me right before I started really working on the manuscript of the book. And I too had, and I'd been a clergy person, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, this whole evolution of seeing how the tradition had distorted the message was tough to hold. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it led to my eventually leaving pastoral ministry. And I felt like, you know, I tried so hard to kind of reclaim it all, but it felt like this misinterpretation and this idea of separateness had gotten so woven into Christian belief. And that includes, like we're saying, judgment and sin. Mm-hmm. And it also includes the idea of Jesus being like separate, like a different kind of person, and God being mm-hmm. separate. So, you know, it's like maybe this idea is so woven into the belief system that it cannot be extricated. Mm-hmm. Like maybe it just can't be extricated. And so I found myself more or less, you know, walking away from it. And then I had this dream, and I had, in waking life, I had visited Israel a few years before this dream and really had been grappling with this, all of this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So in the dream, I returned to Israel. And I'm aware in the dream, as I'm having it, that this is the way that my book, Beyond Jesus, will end. Like the dream is telling me, this is how the book is going to end.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to end with this return visit to Israel. And I'm standing on a lake shore, big lake. I mean, you know, it wasn't identified as the Sea of Galilee. There aren't that many big lakes in Israel. Like that's like the only thing it could be, but it wasn't really identified that way. Mm-hmm. And in the dream, there are two rivers that flow into this lake. And I'm standing on one shore of the lake where one of these rivers flows into the lake. And I'm aware that this is where Jesus was crucified. And mm-hmm. I know it because I can still feel the energetic residue of that event.
Mm.
And the thing that is so clear to me is that it's done. Like, it's done. There was something about, it's hard to convey in words, but there was a finality to it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the dream, I'm both on the ground, you know, in this location, but I'm also sort of able to see from above. And that's how I know that there are two rivers that flow into this lake. So, and then I'm instantly transported to the other side of the lake, where the other river flows in. And this other river flows through this area that's sort of like a cloister or a catacomb or something. And I see here there's a woman who's dressed in a white gown, and she has just undergone some sort of profound experience in a ceremony or a ritual. And she doesn't want to talk about it. Like, it was so powerful, and she doesn't want to talk about it. And finally, I persuade her to tell me what happened. And she begins to tell me, and she says, at one point, Jesus streaked through. And in that moment, I see this male figure, naked, streaking through. And I know that it's Jesus. Mm-hmm. And then a narrator begins to tell me that Jesus was the guru who was assigned to me because of the circumstances of my birth. And then it shows me this image of a woman in India praying with her prayer beads. And it tells me, just as she was assigned a guru because of the circumstances of her birth, so was I. And then I see before me this face with these deep eyes that are looking straight into my own, and I know that this is Jesus' face. And at that point, I wake up. And the dream felt like a resolution for me, like a denouement of my story, mm-hmm. that Jesus functions as a guru who... A guru is someone who has attained their own enlightenment, and their whole purpose is to help others know who they are as well. Like, it's not, the guru is not somebody to be, you know, set apart. Like, the guru is someone who is awakening others to their own nature, which is the same as the guru's. So that dream was so helpful to me to know that, you know, this is the relationship. This is a being who is helping us awaken to our own divine nature, just as he had awakened to his divine nature. And that in this dream, what happened on the crucifixion shore of the lake is done. It is done. And what's happened, that story of separateness, that egoic, you know, nightmare that we've been in, it is done.
Hmm.
It's final. In that moment, it was final. It was finished. And yet, we have clung to the cross. We have kept it alive. We have kept that story alive. And Christian tradition has kept alive the cross when the whole purpose was for it to be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I feel like one of the things that's coming up for me as you're talking is how that could be applied to each individual human person. And I think this is part of what you're suggesting with Jesus as a guru, who, like, that story died in him and he was reborn without that story. And then he could see it everywhere now, the story of separation. So the story of separation died in him. Did it ever live in him or not? I don't know, right? So, you know, what was Jesus's transformation? Right. Did it happen in his 40 days in the desert? When did he right. wake up? I don't know those answers. But hypothetically, during his teaching ministry career, he's already died and been reborn in his consciousness. And he's sharing that. And, you know, people react to it the way they react to it based on where they are in their personal journey. So for that egoic story to collectively die, we all collectively need to wake up. Those of us that are still sleepwalking are still acting it out.
Right. And the way that we're acting it out is, again, by holding on to the cross, which is the symbol of judgment, the symbol of sin. Mm-hmm. It is by holding on to the idea that we are unworthy, by holding on to the idea that we are that we're bad. And let me share another personal experience, and this speaks directly to what you're getting at, Lauren. Some years back, I felt myself like caught between these worlds, right? Mm-hmm. So I'd had this awakening experience. Like I had seen the interconnectedness of reality. I knew that love was all there is. Mm-hmm. Like I could see it. I experienced it. My body experienced it. And as I think happens for a lot of people, we can have these awakening moments, but then, you know, if you hit the snooze button on your alarm, you know, you go back to sleep. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can have these awakening moments where when we come out of the dream, but that doesn't mean we stay awake. We might very well fall back asleep. So it's like a process. It's like one of those mornings, you know, where like I wake up and I fall back asleep and I wake up and it's a process. For a lot of people, it's a process. Mm-hmm. So I was feeling myself caught between these worlds. Like I had seen the reality. I know what that is. Why can't I get back there? Mm-hmm. Like I felt like I was caught. Like if you think about that dream, so on the one shore, it's sort of like the crucifixion shore and the resurrection shore in that dream, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Well, I felt like I was on a bridge between the two. Like I wasn't fully in the crucifixion story. Like I had seen that's an illusion. Oh, and let me tell you that I often think of the word crucifixion as crucifixion. It's a story. Mm-hmm. Judgment, sin, all of that is our fiction. So I'm caught between the crucifixion story that I know is a fiction, and yet I'm not really awake fully. Like I can't get back to that immediate experience of absolute love. And I felt caught, and I was meditating with a friend, and I was just, you know, holding this experience. And in a way, the challenge of that experience, I think, is even more pronounced when you have experienced, you know, that state of consciousness, because you know what you're missing now mm-hmm. when you fall back asleep. Mm-hmm. So I felt like I was on a bridge caught between these worlds, and I couldn't get over. And as I'm coming out of meditation with my friend, the moment I'm coming out of this meditation, I hear the words cross over. And immediately I think, well, duh, what do you think I want to do? Like, I want to cross over. But then I realized, oh, cross over. Like, the cross is over. And I realized what I'd been doing. I had been judging myself for not being fully awake. I had been judging myself for falling back asleep. So it was my own judgment of myself that was keeping me from crossing over. So in other words, I was keeping the cross alive in myself, right? Mm-hmm. And by doing that, I was not crossing over to that state of being and knowing in which everything is love. And we are completely whole and divine and healed and all of that. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that fascinates me is the human journey of this idea that we're spiritual beings having a human experience and how that can unfold at an individual level. And then, of course, there's more the collective consciousness as well. And I'm going to struggle a little bit to articulate this question exactly, but I'm curious if you feel that judgment and this egoic mind is innate to humans, and that part of our path here is to have this awakening and awareness and increasing consciousness, or if that judgment and egoic mind is something that we sort of take on as we become human and learn. And do you, and probably as Lauren says, all things are all things, right? It's probably both. I'm just curious if you have any perspective on that, because of course, you know, this is a podcast aimed at parents and we're thinking about our own essentially raising ourselves and yeah. We're also raising our children. And I'm curious how you see this mapping back to the human sort of path.
Well, I can't claim to know the answer really of how, you know, how this all came about. I don't know that it's an innate state of the human. It's that we entered into this trance. Like this idea arose in the mind, this impossible idea of separateness that is impossible. It doesn't exist. When that idea of separateness arose in the mind, it's as though the mind fragmented, as though the mind fragmented into like this illusory state, and yet its natural state is the knowing of oneness. And so we've been enacting that illusory story that arose from this idea in the mind that's not possible. And judgment is one of the ways that we manage to perpetuate that story. It's one of the ways that we keep our illusion alive. Now, why did we do that? Maybe we wanted to experience something that is impossible. You know, like we go to the movies and we experience something that's not real. Like maybe, I don't know, maybe it was a game we decided to play. It very well might have been. Like let's all play this game. Let's call this game separateness. And in this game, okay, we have to make up the rules here. So in this game, we're going to do this thing that's, we know it's not possible. We know it's make-believe, but let's play along. So we're going to play this game called separateness. And to play this game, we're going to have to forget that we're all one. Like we're going to have to forget that. And so we can do that. How can we forget that? Well, we could maybe like come into like these different bodies so it looks like we're separate. We could play with ideas like when I look at this separate body, I can say, oh, that's different than me. And I can make that body a separate other. And then, you know, if I keep going, then I make it into the enemy. Somewhere along the line, though, we forgot that we were playing a story and it became our reality. It might have been that. I mean, maybe that's what we're doing. We're caught up in this game and we've forgotten that it was a game. That we're just here playing out something that deep inside of ourselves we know isn't possible. And when we enter our right minds, which is, you know, the state of Christ consciousness, when we enter our right minds, we know it's all absurd. It's all absurd. So, you know, where do you go with that as a parent? I think, you know, more and more, I just feel like judgment is like the keystone that keeps the archway in place. You know, without that, the whole story crumbles. And I think that, you know, parents, there's so many different ways to parent. And some ways of parenting totally reinforce the idea of judgment and badness. Mm-hmm. Like you've done something, and rather than understanding that, oh, it was a mistake, we all make mistakes. You know, the idea is, oh, you're bad because you made a mistake. Well, that's simply not true. We're not bad. We can never be bad because we're God in flesh, right? So that's just an impossibility. So there are so many different ways, but to parent in a way that rejects the idea that anything that we do, and this is like I'm almost quoting scripture here, right? Nothing that we do can separate us from love. Mm-hmm. It's not possible. And someone who is, you know, a parent, I imagine has, I'm not a parent, but someone who has had, you know, like someone who has done their own work, you know, with their own woundedness, their own issues, their own ancestral legacy, whatever they've inherited that they need to work through. If they're able to work through that and be in that loving state with their kids, there's nothing that those kids can do that can ever sever the parental love for that child. That child is always, always the beloved child. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, in terms of parenting, just to jettison the whole idea that any of us can ever be, quote, bad, we can make plenty of mistakes. Mm-hmm. And the beautiful thing is that in a way there are no mistakes because everything that we do can enhance our growth. Everything that we do, everything that we experience can enhance our growth and bring us more fully into the realization of who we truly are, which is that divine love.
Beautiful.
Yeah, this is so beautiful. It's bringing up another parenting question for me. And I know we ask you parenting questions, Patricia, and you're not a parent, but you offer so much wisdom. So because I'm thinking about getting into that state of love and unity with our children. I'm thinking about my own personal journey from an old story with parenting and childhood that included judgment and blame and badness that was false. And I've woken up from that. But part of my waking up journey included, so when I was a child, the way boundaries and limits were created and imposed on me were through fear, violence, and this story of badness. And so when I let go of that story, I temporarily lost my ability to set and maintain limits with my children. And then I discovered ideas like loving limits or boundaries with empathy. And so I think I would love to hear what you would say about love and limits, boundaries, and empathy. Because sometimes when I hear you speaking about how the truth is we're all love and anything else is an illusion, you know, and I imagine Jesus accepting the cross, walking to the cross, loving and forgiving the people as they're nailing his hands to the cross, right? That's part of the story. Mm-hmm. And then I think about raising children. And is it loving to let children do anything and everything? And I already see you shaking your head no. So
yeah,
I think
no.
you already know where I'm going.
The act of love, if a child is running towards a swimming pool, you know, a little child doesn't know how to swim, the act of love is to stop them, to set a boundary. Because as an adult, you can see the dangers in a way that they can't yet. Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe it's just something as I know, honey, you want to run that way, but because I love you, I'm not going to let you do it because it could hurt you. Mm-hmm. And so maybe it's even as set in the act of setting the boundary to communicate that I'm doing this because I love you so deeply. And I know that, you know, if you go that way, you're gonna hurt yourself. Now, of course, we reach an age where we have to go that way and hurt ourselves. Like that's part of the growth process. You know, we have to eventually, I think as parents, you know, eventually you have to allow your kids to live their lives and fall into the swimming pool because they are on their own journey. Like, and that mm-hmm. then is the act of love, right? To let them, to release them, to embark on their own discovery of themselves, to find within themselves their own resilience as they face life's challenges. Yeah. And I, you know, I can appreciate how tricky that is as a parent because, you know, it changes. I'm sure it changes with each passing year, you know, those boundaries, move farther out, and how do you discern? And I think it's great that you work with parents because, you know, you can probably help each other discern, like, where, what is the appropriate boundary here? Is this a situation where I should let my daughter, you know, do this thing that she really wants to do, even though I know, you know, she might experience something really unpleasant? You know, where do you draw that line? I don't have that answer, and I don't think there is one answer. Mm-hmm. I think you listen inwardly to your own loving heart. And at that point, then you're available as the parent for them to, you know, you don't judge them for what they've done. You make yourself available to help them process whatever transpires as a result of their choices. So, you know, I can appreciate the difficulty of that, and you know how it is that the loving act initially is very much to set boundaries, because you know things that little kids don't know. Mm-hmm. You just do.
Yeah, beautiful. Mm-hmm.
I'd love to finish us out by taking us back to the dream that you shared with the nuns tending the butterflies.
Yeah.
That feels like such an aha moment for me. I have often thought about this Christianity as an institution and the different ways to relate with that institution. And I love seeing at the heart these nuns tending these butterflies. And like, it makes me want to cry, really, thinking about that keeping of that possibility of transformation for humans actually is there in the center of it all. And I wonder if you could just speak to a couple things that I noticed in that. One is, do you make something of the fact that it was nuns? And do you think about the divine feminine? And do you think about these butterflies being released?
Yeah. So what great questions. I just published today a blog post on the divine, on the return of the feminine and the return to the feminine. Absolutely. It had to be nuns, because it has been the patriarchal tradition that has played out and perpetuated the egoic story. So it makes total sense to me that in the dream it was the nuns. And Jesus is, in a sense, you could see him as the divine feminine in masculine form.
Mm.
Because he exhibited very pronounced feminine qualities. And we are at a point now where the feminine principle is arising again, and it is coming back into, you know, the masculine and the feminine energies are coming back into balance. And I, you know, even in Jesus' day, it was the women who understood what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It was the women. And it was the women who had the wherewithal, who had the inner strength and resilience to bear witness to the crucifixion. And they understood that bearing witness to this act is important. Like, we are not going to run away from this. We are going to bear witness. And in the, you know, in the gospel stories, it's always the women who see the resurrected Christ first. So, you know, and women's voices, of course, became suppressed, and women's leadership became marginalized. All the while, this patriarchal interpretation of the cross and the egoic interpretation of the cross and the crucifixion became solidified in the institution. Mm-hmm. It makes total sense to me that it was the nuns who were nurturing this, keeping it alive. And I know plenty of nuns, and they are like, wow, radical. A lot of them are very, very radical. And the transformation that we are experiencing now, and the arising of this, of the Christ consciousness and the reemergence of the feminine, it is going to come about from a feminine way of knowing. and a feminine way of creating, which is to join with the new, like to not make it, to not manufacture it, not design it or strategize or plan for it, but to be it and to allow it to gestate within us and be birthed through us. So absolutely, it had to be the nuns in the dream. And I do believe that the butterflies are finding their way out into the world. And yes. And, you know, as you said earlier, Lauren, you know, the caterpillars, when we're in the caterpillar state, you know, we see the butterfly and we don't understand it. We might even be offended by it. We might even be offended by a butterfly who lands in front of us and says, metamorphose, metamorphose, metamorphose. It's like, maybe it's just not my time yet. And I don't know who you are, but get out of my face. So I do believe that, you know, this metamorphosis is happening inwardly in countless people. And the more people that are experiencing it, the more we are shifting the planetary consciousness, and it's going to become easier and easier and easier for all of us to open up to this consciousness and to sustain it within ourselves and to anchor it on the planet and give it form in a new world, a world that reflects the reality and the truth of love.
I love that. Patricia, it is such a gift to be in your presence and to have you share your wisdom with us. Thank you so much.
Well, I always enjoy these conversations so much, and I just cherish your presence, both of you, and the way that you invite all of this forth. I mean, I haven't articulated a lot of this in language before, and it's your capacity to listen and invite it that brings it forth. So I see this as a co-creative act, and I really am very, very grateful for you inviting me to be here today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I love that.
We hope that you enjoyed that conversation as much as we did. We just find Patricia to be pure magic. And if you want to immerse yourself more in her teachings and her words, we have two suggestions. Her beautiful memoir is called Beyond Jesus. It is available at a link that we'll have in the show notes and on the episode page. And she has generously given our listeners 25% off the book with the code SoulPath, all one word. And she also has a website, patriciapierce.com, where she has blogs and shares her other courses and ways that you can further your inspiration with her. So with that, we will conclude today's show. We hope that you enjoyed it as much as we did. And until we talk again, be well.